So here's what Suzuki Roshi said. He said, our effort is to observe the precepts. I think we can all agree about that. Our effort is to observe the precepts. When you ask whether your way is perfect or not, this is an insidious idea of self. Okay, so let me digress a little bit here from my kind of opening remarks. Although this idea is not definitely not a digression, it's a primary tool and idea and way and method and the part of practice, which is how we practice no self. So this, he says, whether your way is perfect or not, this is an insidious idea of self. So what he's talking about is when we practice the precepts, do not kill, do not slander, do not harbor ill will, for example. So if we get very rigid about that, and we get very judgmental about that, if we get judgmental with ourselves about it, or we get judgmental with other people about it. So, for example, talking about relationships, and if we have a relationship in which it's a difficult one, and we say, well, I'm a victim here, this person didn't follow the precepts, it's just to tie this into the theme here. So, or we beat ourselves up, we say, oh, I didn't do this thing, I'm really a bad person because I didn't follow the precepts, I harbor ill will. These are all attachments to self. So when we relate to ourselves or relate to other people or relate to ideas we have about other people, we want to have a sense of fluidity. I'm not saying that we should be abused, so please don't think that that's what this is about. So it's not about this extreme of putting ourselves in an abusive situation. This is about normal, neurotic people trying to get through their day with each other and having a lot of history and having ways in which we have real difficulties with each other. Nobody's evil, nobody's inherently bad, just not skillful. A way in which we're not skillful. We hurt, we've had our feelings hurt, we have our own history, we're struggling, and sometimes we're just not skillful. And that's true for all of us. Even if we practice a religion or practice a moral code or whatever it is, we still make mistakes. We still get caught. We still have these intermeshing, difficult relationships. So he says, if we make it into a kind of box that we put ourselves in, that is a way in which we are caught in some way that we're reifying ourself. We're saying, this self is a certain way. I can't change. This self is a particular thing. We have no fluidity. We're caught in criticism. So he's saying this too is a practice in which we're caught in, I don't want to use the word aggrandizing exactly, but caught in some kind of unwholesome definition of the nature of what self is. So remember that when we talk about no self, we're not saying that you don't have a personality. We're not saying that you don't have a particularity called whatever your name, right? This particularity, who you are. What we're saying is that we don't have a reified self. We don't have a self that is disconnected from all being. We don't have a self that is not the effects of causes and conditions. So we can't say about ourselves that we're always a certain way. We can't say about ourselves that we're fixed. But actually, our self is in relationship. We're in relationship with other people. We're in relationship with the whole world. When we eat something and it gets digested and turned into energy for our body, that's relational. That's a way in which we're dependent upon the world to help us to live. So that's this, a relational fluid thing that's happening. When we breathe in air, that's a relational fluid thing. Actually, when we breathe in air, we're in a small room here. Chances are good that, I don't know how long this takes, but we are actually breathing in each other's air, which means that you and I are functioning together and are interconnected on a cellular level with each other. So we're not separate. And so this is this way that we talk about the self, that we need to really take a look at that. And it does relate to the precepts. So when we have this way of following the precepts, which is inclusive, following the precepts, which has a kind of flexibility, following the precepts with kindness and compassion, that is this way of dropping the self. This is a way that we drop the self. My mom was kind of a difficult person, and she, out of nervousness, I think, she talked all the time. And that was really hard for me initially because I felt like she was annihilating myself, right? It's like when you're with somebody and they dominate the space all the time, you don't feel like there's any space for you. And so you start to feel upset about it, you know, especially with our parents. We want them to be terribly interested in us and not so interested in just doing a running monologue 24/7. We used to have a joke about my mom. You remember those fish that, you know, go, you go by and they go, take me to the river, like that, right? And so we would joke that my mom was like that. When you left the room, she would stop talking, and when you came back, she'd just pick up where she left off and keep going. So this was, like, really hard for me. But so what I started to do is when I started practicing, after a while, I started practicing with that. So every time I saw her, I would say, this is a practice of no self. And that wasn't easy. I would sit there and I'd go, wow, you know, this is really boring. So we had this joke we would do, which is where we would eat nuts. My mom would talk and we would eat. So, you know, you'd say, well, that's not practice. But it is practice because it's this way of saying, how do I take care of myself in this difficult situation where I'm struggling with working with the self? And so I would do... It took me years to figure out how to let go of that. It took me years to say, yeah, you know, this is not about me. This is not about me. How would I be with somebody that I didn't have this long relationship with if they just talked all the time? What would I think about that? So this way of letting go, and it isn't easy. You have to just keep coming back and coming back and coming back. When I talked to my mom on the phone, I always had magazines. So I'd talk to her on the phone. She couldn't see me. So I would look at magazine pictures while I was talking to her because that was a way to kind of like not distract myself in a little way, not to get upset about it. So it's okay to develop strategies. And by the time she died, you know, it was fine. It was like I was no longer attached to my mother being a different person, being somebody who was going to support me in the way that I thought I should be supported. So this is this cultivation of a kind of flexibility of response. So that's what the precepts are. It's this cultivation of this kind of response. So Suzuki Roshi says, our effort to observe the precepts, when you ask whether your way is perfect, so in this case, my idea about the kind of relationship I had with my mom, I thought was perfect, right? That's the way it should be. Not so that cut her out of the picture altogether. Whatever might be going on with her was not important to me. I just wanted her to respond. I had years of, you know, whoa, get these, you know, screamer letters and yada-da-da-da. But ultimately, it was just about letting go of some sense of self that I had about how I wanted things to be a certain way. Again, the Four Noble Truths, right? What's the cause of suffering? Getting something that you don't want, not getting something you do want, and attachment to self. So these are kind of primary big three suffering points. So he says, when you ask whether your way is perfect or not, there is an insidious idea of self. When you do your best to observe the precepts, to practice Zen within big mind, so this is this inclusive mind, then there is enlightenment. Then there is enlightenment. Although I would not say that this is the definition of enlightenment, it is also a path to not suffering. Right? But to get to that place of not suffering, we have to let go of our grip on the self. To an extent, we have to like pry our fingers off of the self and start just letting it go. In a wholesome way. Again, this is not about letting somebody abuse you. So there's this big mind. This mind is big mind is inclusive mind. Big mind is the mind that has some wisdom and flexibility and compassion. The technical definition of wisdom, prajna, in Buddhism is lack of inherent self, of self and others. So this way, self and things. So it is the emptiness of this inherent self. That's wisdom. Compassion is that we are inclusive. So that both words mean exactly the same thing. They're just looking at it from a different perspective. Compassion just means that we are passionate with, we are in community with, we understand our interconnected nature. Lack of inherent existence just means we don't have a separate existence from everything else. It means that when we eat, we're eating food that has been or is a plant or an animal or whatever. We are in these interconnected relationships. So we know that we can't exist, that we can't come into being without a lot of causes and conditions coming together to make that happen, which is true for everything. And we know that we're in this complete interconnected relationship. That is lack of inherent existence. And the Tibetans often talked about a third kind of leg of the stool, which is skillful means. So what happens when we are compassionate? What happens when we realize that things are more flexible, less reified, less fixed, when we realize that we're in it with all beings? Well, we're skillful. And that's really what the precepts are, is they are guidelines for having this skillful response to our lives. And it's messy and it's hard. We get caught, but we keep coming back to this. We keep trying to come back to our big mind, coming back to this enlightened mind. Dogen says, practice realization. Our practice is a reflection of our big mind. We do not practice to become enlightened. Our practice, when we do something skillful, when we engage in practice, even when we're making mistakes, as long as the mistakes are this sincere effort in which we are intelligently looking at our actions, we break a precept, we intelligently look at this precept, look at our action and say, how is that? What is that? Is this helpful? Is it skillful? So this is this way that's practice. And that's an expression of our big mind. It's not an expression of our small mind. Our small mind is the mind that says, oh, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm not dealing with this, I'm going to the movies. Now that's small mind. So, and when we experience small mind, our big mind might say, maybe I need a little space here. How can I be compassionate with myself? Little mind is the mind that says, no, I'm going to beat you up. I'm going to beat you up because you're a bad person. So this big mind has a kind of kindness and spaciousness to it. All right, so an example of this with one of the precepts is, this comes from a text called the Kyoju Kaimon. Kyoju Kaimon, which means instructions given on the precepts that Dogen wrote. This is supposed to be a commentary on what's called the Bodhidharma one-minded precepts, which may or may not be historically accurate. So Dogen said about the precept, I vow not to take what is not given. So we do this, we do these precepts with Dogen's commentary. When we do the Bodhisattva ceremony at the end, you know, we'll read out and then we'll do the Doshi or the teacher will do the second part of this. So this is from the Kyoju Kaimon. So the precept is, I vow not to take what is not given. And then the commentary is, the self and objects are such as they are. The self and objects are such as they are. Two, yet one. The gate of liberation stands open. So what is this saying? He's saying that when we talk about not taking what is not given, which is another word would be stealing. So not taking what is not given. So what is the deeper meaning of that precept? What does it mean to say to not take something that is not given? So it could be you have a crush on somebody, they don't have a crush on you, you're trying to force them to fall in love with you. That would be an example of trying to take something that is not given. Somebody is, you say something that's not very nice to somebody about something that they've done, or you say to somebody who's shown you some work that they've done, you say, well, that's not very good, and maybe you're unskillful about it. That's taking what is not given. Person is asking for help or criticism, but they're not asking to be completely demoralized and stripped down. So there's this way that maybe we've gone too far. So that's taking what is not given. So these are ways that we can take that precept that have a deeper meaning than just saying, I'm not going to walk down to my doctor's office with a pen that was on the desk for me to sign the form, right? Or I'm stealing pencils, or I'm not going to go break into somebody's house and steal their bicycle or something like that. So we tend to put stealing in that kind of category, but actually it has much more subtle meaning. So then Dogen says, the self and objects are such as they are. So this, when we sit in Zen, we say things just as they are. Talked about this last week. Things just as they are. And in the weekly quote, things just as they are. And we would say in Zen, that is the one great matter. What does it mean to say things just as they are? So these things just as they are includes this way in which everything is completely interconnected, and yet there is particularity. So there is this way in which you are you, I am me, the watch is the watch, the podium is the podium, the tree is the tree. So there's this way that there's also simultaneously particularity. We say form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is none other than emptiness, emptiness is none other than form. So in this way we say there's form and there's emptiness. They're not separate from each other. So we say something lacks inherent existence, which is definition of empty of inherent existence. That would be the absolute, which we tend to reify and make into something that's separate and different from form, separate and different from phenomena. But actually, phenomena and emptiness are not separate from each other. Emptiness does not exist outside the realm of form. Emptiness is a way of talking about the nature of relationship. So form, phenomena, is empty of inherent existence. Empty of inherent existence is form. So they're not separate events, but we tend to get caught and then we think, oh, I should be trying to be in the absolute somehow. You're not. You're in your body, right? Phenomena exist. We are form. So, but this realization that our form is also empty means that we realize that we're in these interconnected relationships. We realize that we're part of a larger thing than just this body, this form. And when we really deeply realize that, our responses are going to be different than they are when we're just coming from this place. It's hard, actually, not to come from this place because we understand the world through our perceptions, right? And how do we perceive our perceptions? My eyesight. I see out of my eyes. When I look out, I'm looking out and seeing you. And you're looking and seeing me. So there's this way in which our perceptions fool us. The way we hear, the way we feel things, our perceptions fool us about the nature of our experience. Because we feel like that we are this brain, we are this nervous system, and that it stops. For me, it stops right here, right? But that's not actually how it is. Or I should say something like, it is and it isn't. It is that it stops here, but it isn't that it stops here. So Dogen says, the self and objects are such as they are. So that's how they are. Two, yet one. So he's saying there is this oneness, which is not the absolute. There is this oneness. The absolute is a reified notion of something outside the self. But there is this oneness in which we are all process. We are all in this interconnected relationship with each other. So we're all in this process with each other. The whole world is process. That's one way to look at it. Anyway, one way to talk about it. The world as verb, not noun. So we tend to see the world as noun coming from this place. But actually, it's more like a verb. And that's the extent of my grammar, so I won't go any further. but we're actually in this interactive relationship and dependent and interconnected, interpenetrating. So this is the one and two. So the two carries the sense of individual form. The sense of subject-object. So there is subject-object, and simultaneously there is just this thing called life. He says the gate of liberation stands open. If we realize this, we see the gate of liberation. But the gate of liberation is always standing open. Because this is just reality as it is. This is not something, we don't have to crash the gates. The Mumon Khan, a collection of koans, means the gateless gate. So that's the irony of it, if you will. We think there's a gate there, but actually it's a gateless gate. But we keep banging on the gate. But the only reason there's a gate there is because we make the gate. So as soon as we understand the gate's not there, we see this gateless gate. We say, the gate of liberation stands open. Unfortunately, it seems to be our nature that we just get caught over and over again. The precepts are a way of paying attention. The precepts are a way of realizing that we got caught. The precepts are a way of saying, gateless gate. The gate of liberation stands open. Well, you might not do it exactly this way. The gate of liberation stands open. Why am I caught here? You know, what is it? And what it comes back to, essentially, is usually an attachment to self in some way. Wanting to have it a certain way. I want it to be a certain way. It's not that way. I'm going to suffer, and you know what? Other people are going to suffer too. Maybe we don't do that second part, but inevitably that also goes along with it, is that when we're suffering, other people suffer too. So this is this the way that Dogen's talking about it here. I vow not to take what is not given. The self and objects are such as they are. So there is perhaps some notion of something to steal. There is perhaps some notion of something to take that is not given. So there's that. There is the subject-object relationship there. He says that self, that person who wants to take, that thing that wants to be taken or that we want to take, the object, the self and objects are such as they are. There really is form, there really is subject-object, and yet simultaneously, there are no subjects and objects. Simultaneously, if we take something that is not given, we are essentially stealing from ourselves. We are essentially creating suffering for ourselves, as well as suffering for the other. The thing is, we don't see that we're suffering, because we have this notion that if we can just get this thing, have this thing, we'll be happy. We all know that phenomena, right? It's like we get something. Remember, I'm sure you know, it's like when we're little kids There's some commercial that used to be on last year or something, and they show these little kids just ripping through Christmas presents, you know. All these Christmas presents, just, you know, this maelstrom of paper and things like that. And when you're little kids, you know, can you remember that just visceral body feeling of wanting something for Christmas? Maybe some Jewish folks are. I don't know what Hanukkah's like. If you
same
get,
thing.
Same
it's
thing.
Sort of present.
Yeah. So this kind of when we're little kids, the greed factor can be pretty high about whatever it is, or a birthday. You know, God, I really want this thing for my birthday. Oh, you know, we got to get this thing, and then you get this thing, and then you know, it's really interesting for an hour, 2 hours, 3 days, a week, whatever. But inevitably, we grow out of it. It changes, or it's not so much fun, or the vacuum cleaner we bought isn't what we thought it was going to be, and now we want another one because it doesn't work as well as what we hoped it would, yada-da-da-da, right? So there's always something like that. And this is suffering. This is suffering. So this notion of not taking what is not given, the self and objects are such as they are, two yet one, and the gate of liberation stands open. So this gate of liberation, is it really up to us? It's really up to us. You can walk through the gate or not walk through the gate. But sometimes walking through the gate feels like we have to fight our way through a web of suffering. And we're convinced that we don't have to suffer. We don't have to do the work. But usually doing the work, it's kind of like addiction. You know, when you're addicted to something, it's really hard to stop doing it. And because it's so hard to stop doing it, you convince yourself that you actually feel better doing it than you do when you don't do it. And in the case of physical addiction, your whole body is like going, give me, I must have, you know. I will go out and steal for this thing. But then when we can actually get out from under the addiction, we realize how oppressed we've been. We realize how bad we feel and how horrible it's been. So the oppression of self can be like that. And the precepts help us find the gate. The precepts are kind of like when you're a pilot and you're coming up to the runway and you see all those lights, right? It's like, oh, okay, there are the lights. Now that's the runway. You know, I want 32B. Got to go down that runway. That's the runway of not taking what is not given. Thank you very much. I'm going to stop there.